This is Germ Warfare, the battle of ideas.
My name is Germ. This is Germ Warfare, the battle of ideas. Mark Conlon, thank you for joining me in the trenches.
Glad to be here. Thanks for asking me onto the show.
It's an absolute pleasure. Mark, what is your background?
Right. My background, I do have a professional background. My main background now is looking into this area of the 9/11 planes research. So I've been at this since about 2013, although I've always suspected something wrong with 9/11 since around about 2004-5. Initially, I got into this area of, if you want to call it, conspiratorial cover-ups and things like that, around about 1988, after watching The Men Who Killed Kennedy documentary that was aired in the UK. So that just set me off from there with a healthy scepticism on what was told. Since 2013, I've been posting my research. But what got me started with that was because I seen that there was some type of psychological operation going on surrounding the plane crashes. There was a lot of disinfo being put out, which I got caught up with myself. And it got me on that path to really deep diving into this research and exposing some of the misinformation surrounding this, what they used to call video fakery and CGI planes. I found out a lot of that was pretty much leading people off on a false path. And it was also covering something very important up to do with technology surrounding how them planes were, how it was deployed, the actual psychological operation on the day.
With that in mind, why does this conversation matter then? I mean, it seems like so long ago now.
Because to me, this technology that they possess, they will use again. And it was a trial on 9/11, and it could lead to something a lot more sinister down the line. And I feel it's my job to expose this technology at my own detriment as well, by the way, of to get it out there to the public, because we don't want them to be fooled like there was on 9/11. My central talking point in 2023 and 4 is surrounding showing a lot of information that hasn't been told to do with telemetry data surrounding the planes. It's almost, some of it has been forgotten, but I've also looked into a lot of declassified documents to do with the investigation into 9/11, and it paints a very, very different picture. And added with some research that some of the research has done many years ago, and with my own research, it paints a new narrative of how this operation was executed, you know, to pull off this illusion.
What was the illusion?
So the illusion was there was some type of technology used to create those planes in the sky, what people witnessed. The other illusion is the actual plane crashes themselves, because it is impossible physics, Newton's third law of physics. And doesn't matter how many people want to try and dress that up and, you know, the plane would have gone into the building like that, would have knocked down all the light poles and still been intact and showed up in this CCTV footage now, what people are presenting at the Pentagon. It just wouldn't be that way. That plane wouldn't be intact. Its wings wouldn't be intact after going through 5 light poles.
I've also looked at the Pentagon, and it seems pretty absurd to think that there was a plane that flew into it. If one looks at the stills of the Twin Towers, it just looks ridiculous.
Yes. It's a plane-shaped hole. There's lots of anomalies with the way them beams have been sliced through, which a plane just wouldn't do. And the direction and the way them beams look suggests that there's something else at play, some type of black budget technology. But also, you know, on the other hand, we have evidence to back up some of the things surrounding those crashes, actually, you know, whether it's seismic readings, Earth's magnetometer data, just very strange things. People stood in the holes, You know, if this was a high heat event, I don't think you'd have people walking out them holes and, you know, on the edge of the building in those plane gashes, which is what we've seen.
Yeah, you've got a few visuals to show me. I'm quite excited.
Yeah, yeah. Well, my main case is I have to see, it's okay saying to somebody, no planes hit the towers, and they're not going to buy that. You've got to demonstrate that the named planes, if you was going into court, you'd be looking at things like chain of evidence. You'd be looking at those named planes went to those targets that we were told that they crashed into. Now, we have telemetry data which completely contradicts that, which has been pushed away to the side by various, shall I say, researchers who don't want to confront that information. So I feel it's my job to bring that type of discrepancies in this official telemetry data and, you know, and testimonies to the public and let them decide then, you know, whether them planes went into those buildings. From the outset, and this is something that not many researchers will talk about, especially people who push the narrative that the planes went into the buildings, the named planes, I should say. So what we're looking at here is we're looking at none of the four aircrafts crashed on 9/11. You should have had four events of those plane crashes. You should have had what they call an emergency locator transmission at all four events. Now, there wasn't even one emergency locator transmitter. Now, I'm just going to explain what an emergency locator transmitter is briefly. Essentially, that is something that's situated mainly in 767s and other aircrafts in the back of the aircraft. And what happens is when that plane crashes, it can trigger distress signal, and that helps them to locate the plane. You see, and when the plane impacts or crashes, it will send that signal out that it's crashed. Some aircrafts can be activated manually, these emergency locator transmitters. But as we're going to see now, this is where they're normally located, just so people can have a look and get the head around that. So what the big problem is for Flight 11 and Flight 175 is they're both 767 planes. Now, we've got an expert commission witness who is in the documents, which I feel have been ignored for a long time, and he says you cannot manually activate ELT from a 767 Boeing. You just can't activate them. It's impossible. Plus, in those aircrafts, the threshold setting, so the parameters, is set very low. So if it does like a bank or a heavy turn, a bit like your car alarm, if a bus goes past, it doesn't set the alarm off. So these are fundamentally very important pieces of information. It's actually on record in the commission that you cannot set an ELT off in a Boeing 767 aircraft. And that's by Paul Thumser. Now, the problem we've got is, so with Flight 11, 75, 77 and 93, we had no emergency locator transmitter transmissions at all. Now, this is also backed up in the NTSB final report. The ELT section is left blank. But what I do have people suggesting is there was two ELTs which was reported in New York by a pilot of US 583. To air traffic control. Now, these reports came in at 8:44 and the other report came in at 8:58. Now, the 8:44, some people are trying to attribute to Flight 11. Now, we know in the official story that Flight 11 did not crash until 8:46. And we know that United 175 didn't crash till 9:03. The thing is with an ELT, you cannot trace it back to an aircraft, but the trouble with 11 and trying to attribute these two ELTs to 11 and 175, the problem is you cannot manually activate an ELT in those two planes. So we can sort of rule out those erroneous ELTs that were reported.
And this is official?
And that's official, yeah. That's in documents, yeah. And I can prove that. I've got both a paper base of those documents. I've also got digital archives which I've made available. So we can conclude that neither of those early ELTs came, from, you know, originated from AA11 and 175. So, and that is also backed up with the next area I'm going to go to with the telemetry data. So, just to add, by the way, this is Paul Thumzo, who's an experienced ex-pilot and radar operator, and he's also a trainer. He's on record in the 9/11 Commission on Classified Sensitive Documents released under a Freedom of Information Act in 2009. And he's clarifying that this, you know, this expert pilot and his air expert, you know, witness that you cannot activate an ELT in a Boeing 767 aircraft. So, like I say, that rules out of any manual activation of Flight 11, Flight 175. And that's in the commission own documents. And there's a document there on the screen, which I'm referring to. He also talks about parameters. So what I'm doing, Jeremy, is I'm building a case to show that these planes and possibly where they went as I go along in this presentation.
So just to clarify, four planes didn't crash, but there were four planes in some respect.
Yes, yes. Yes, it's quite a complex, what I've been looking into and what I put forward is quite complex because it was an operation. It was done under the guise of these war games on 9/11 that were taking place. I've amassed quite a lot of evidence since I did the film, which you may know about, with Chris Hampton, which was 9/11 Alchemy. So, and we covered the plane, a lot of the, how the plane crashes were carried out in that film using illusion technology. Sounds quite out of space, but as I go on, I can sort of demonstrate what I'm talking about and what I've gleaned from a lot of the information, and a lot of it is official information. So if you're going to tell somebody what I'm saying is that this was an operation carried out using some type of illusion technology and those planes never crashed at those targets, I've got to prove that. You see, that's my first step, is I have to prove that point. So I'm going to put forward now is all four planes were still airborne at the time of the crashes, and I'm going to present some evidence now to sort of prove that. So we have Flight 11, which was reported as still being airborne on the NORAD communications recordings after the alleged crash at 8:46, and it's said to have been heading to Washington. And during this recording, they gave the precise lat-long coordinates of the plane for Flight 11, and they gave Flight 11's tail number. Now, when you put them coordinates in, which I did, it shows that Flight 11 was 5.77 miles past the North Tower. And this is after, you know, it crashed. So we have to explain that. And again, this is not me saying, it's not my opinion, this is what's on in their own evidence and own recordings.
Military Boston Center just had a report that American 11 is still in the air and it's on its way towards heading towards Washington.
Okay, American 11 is still in the air?
Yes,
on its way towards Washington?
There was definitely another aircraft that hit the tower. That's the latest report we have.
Okay.
I'm going to try to confirm an ID for you, but I would assume he's somewhere over either New Jersey or somewhere further south.
Okay, so American 11 isn't a hijack at all then, right?
No, he is a hijack.
American 11 is a hijack.
Yes.
And he's going into Washington?
This could be a third aircraft.
Okay, third aircraft hijack heading towards Washington. No.
Okay, American Airlines is still airborne. 11, the first guy, he's heading towards Washington. Okay, I think we need to scramble Langley right now, and I'm gonna take the fighters from Otis and try to chase this guy down if I can find him. Yeah. You sure?
Yeah, MCC.
Okay. He's heading towards Langley, or I should say Washington. American 11, the original guy, he's still airborne. We're still getting a... We're getting a position.
Got
a position?
A couple of hijacks on the real world. Gotta go.
All right, they are...
Okay. Foxy, scramble Langley, head towards the Washington area.
Roger that.
Could be American...
Hold on a second.
We're trying to get a code on this guy right now. We do have a tail number. It's a... Oh, we're... It's... tail number.
November
334 Alpha Alpha. If we can find him, we're trying to get to mode. We're trying to get position on this guy. So then we'll run on him. Yep. Okay. Bye.
Okay.
Hi, this is Huntress calling. I was told to give you a buzz for our mission crew commander. Any information? I guess three aircraft out of Boston are missing, and apparently two of them have hit the World Trade Center, and one is en route to Washington. Did you get that information? Yes. American 1-1 is not the aircraft that crashed. It is still airborne. Did you get that information? That's what we just found out. We don't know where it is, though. It's headed towards Washington was the last known information.
Washington better get on the
Huntress ID, unsecure line.
Huntress ID, this is Washington Center, the operations manager.
Go ahead, sir.
Okay, I guess you had called here a couple times. You never talked to me, but if there's anything you need or anything I can help you with, let me know what it is right now, please.
Okay, do you want me to let you know what we have going on, sir?
I would, yes. Well, okay. I have a pretty good idea, but yes.
Okay, the three aircraft missing out of Boston. I just spoke with Boston, and they said that they're not sure of the third aircraft call sign, but they do have two. One of them is United 175.
Uh-huh.
The other one is American 1-1.
Right.
They thought that the American 1-1 was the aircraft that crashed into the World Trade Center with the United 175. However, American 1-1 is not the aircraft that crashed. He said the pilot on American 1-1 was talking to him, having a rough time telling him what's going on. There was threats in the cockpit being made. This was the initial hijack information that we got, American 1-1 767 from Boston to Los Angeles. Proposed route, he was headed towards JFK at the time that they lost contact, but that was not the aircraft headed into the World Trade Center that hit it.
Okay.
That's what Boston's saying. The last known, and I'm not sure where we heard it through the grapevine, people calling, is that American 1-1 was headed towards Washington, and that's the only thing.
Was headed toward where?
Washington.
Okay.
So your AOR, and I just wanted to give you a heads up.
Okay. Go ahead.
The last known lat long that we had, primary target only was 4038 North, 07403 West on American 1-1.
That proves, if you listen to the NORAD tapes, they're on record. And again, that this is official evidence from their recording showing that Flight 11 was not the plane that allegedly crashed into the North Tower. And it's still airborne. It's heading to Washington. That will come into play why it was heading to Washington a little bit later, as I explain. So now we've sort of proven that Flight 11 is still airborne. Okay, I'm going to move on to Flight 175. We've got some telemetry data called the ACARS data. What the ACARS data is, it's called the Aircraft Communications Addressing and Reporting System. Now, that was sending messages from ground stations and communicating with Flight 175. Okay, so you have various ground stations plotted all over America, and these are to do with the ACARS ground radio stations. Now, when a plane's flying, a little bit like a cell phone, it will try and connect to the nearest ground station to route the messages up and down to the plane. So what we found out was, this came about through Pilots for 9/11 Truth. The ACARS data showed that at the time, Flight 175 was actually over Harrisburg and Pittsburgh at the time of when Flight 175 allegedly crashed into the South Tower. That shouldn't be happening if that plane's turned around and gone back towards New York. It shouldn't be picking up, having their messages routed through.
Would people on the ground not have seen these two planes?
Possibly, but I don't know if they would know that they was the particular, you know, the planes that were involved.
Mm.
It would be quite hard to identify, I think, as a normal
right.
eyewitness or, you know. So this slide here is, I'm just making a visual. So in the slide here, it's 8:59, and this is allegedly Flight 175's route and where it was. And this is the ground station here that's picking up the ACARS communications. So what this is suggesting, this would be more as if the plane would be over in this vicinity, it should be communicating. They have like a radius of these ground stations. Now, really, Flight 175 should be picking up ACAR's messages more in this vicinity of its radius, not over here, which is very, very strange. And plus, we know when we look at the next slide from the telemetry data that it was still communicating and being received by the plane, the message, because it puts a little chime. We know that the message that was sent at 9:03 and 17 seconds, and we know Flight 175 had crashed at 9:03 and 11 seconds, it was still communicating with that plane. And that was in, I think it was Harrisburg, over in this particular area here. And then the planes crashed over there. So this is impossible. So what it's suggesting is, Jeremy, that Flight 175 didn't make this turn here. It more than likely carried on in this vicinity to be receiving those messages.
And not just that, the alleged pilots weren't terribly skilled either.
No, exactly, according to the official story. And as I go on, just when I at the end, it will make sense why possibly, you know, these flights were behaving the way they was and what was actually taking place. But we can conclusively say that Flight 175 did not make that turn there. It more than likely carried on in this particular area to be communicating with this ground station on the ACARS messaging system. So again, this suggests Flight 175 was still airborne, which I'm going to produce some more evidence to show that it was still airborne. It was still airborne for quite a considerable amount of time as well after the crash. So we have a piece of damning evidence here to show that Flight 175 was still airborne, because at 25 past 10 on MSNBC News, it shows Flight 175 is still airborne over Connecticut. Now, this was captured when they showed a live on-screen software of Flight Explorer, which is a program that operates in real time with FAA. Now, they was doing the ground stop of all the planes. In the clip, it shows that they are showing what planes are still in the air on this clip.
We were watching on our Flight Explorer. I don't know if we can put it on the air right now. This is a system in which we can actually look at the number of airplanes in the air. Normally, this would be dotted with little blue airplane figures. Look at how few we're looking. It looks like only three over the immediate New York City metropolitan area. Just a handful. Airplanes in the air are being allowed to land at their destinations, and then that is it. Now, keep in mind, the planes you're looking at here are only those that are participating in the FAA radar system, airliners. This does not include anybody in a small Cessna or a small plane who might be flying what's called VFR traffic, where they're just flying below the commercial traffic. But again, these represent commercial airplanes or airplanes that are participating in the FAA system, just a handful in the skies over the Northeast right now.
That flight was heading, it was actually captured over Connecticut, which is just up from New York, and it appears to be heading back to Boston. But it's been in the air quite a long time now. United could not confirm until, I think it was after about 11:15, half past 11, that was the plane that was involved. Now, my contention there is they couldn't confirm it was involved because it was still airborne. They'd have had, if it was found out it was still airborne at the time they're trying to say it was involved, then they're going to have egg on the faces and it's going to look bad. Bad for them. So I think they had to wait till that plane was landed, which when you look at the timing between Connecticut and Boston, and there doesn't seem to be any other sort of, because it was at 35,000 feet as well, what it shows in that clip. So it's not coming in to land at any of them airports along that corridor. And it seems to be heading towards Boston when you strike a line through it, which I think was about 170 miles away. And so it looked like it possibly could have been heading back to Boston, you know, for a landing perhaps. Well, so let's move on. Flight 77. Now, a lot of people are not aware of some official data that came out under the Freedom of Information Act. And it was some, it's on a CD to do some radar data, and it's the DCC radar evidence. And what this shows is it shows that American Airlines Flight 77 did not turn round, as we were told, on the Kentucky and Ohio border. Now, what this radar evidence shows, and it's backed up with some other evidence on air traffic control as well, so it's not just one piece of evidence. So this shows that the radar picks up Flight 77 heading over towards Missouri, and it flies over St. Louis Airport, and it flies near, well, just about into Kansas before making a turn and heading back towards Missouri, where it strangely goes off radar heading towards St. Louis Airport. You know, I can't categorically say that it landed at St. Louis Airport, even though I've got a photograph. And out of a number of planes, there's an AA, American Airlines plane, 757, that happens to be sat alongside a lot of other planes. So, and that's on 9/11. However, I can't identify that plane, but I suspect it possibly landed at St. Louis Airport for other reasons as well, which I won't go into here, but there are other reasons why I suspect it landed there. Again, what we're showing is we've got AA-77, which is still airborne at the time of the crash, and it's still flying at 35,000 feet. And it was picked up on radar. And also, it's spoken about in the air traffic control transcripts. They talk about tracking with a question mark, AA-77 over Missouri. They talk about it heading that way. You know, so this just isn't one piece of evidence. There's two or three pieces of evidence suggesting that. And it's also, again, we go back to the day after 9/11. On CNN, they actually show the flight path here. They show it as not turning, and the plane is still green. That means it's still showing some type of data block linked to the plane to identify it, because when they go into primary, it just comes up as a blip, no information. But what it shows here on their version of Flight Explorer, it shows that it doesn't make the turn round here. It actually carries on and then disappears into primary. So again, we've been lied to about this turn, which is a common theme with all the planes. So that's a third piece of evidence showing it didn't turn round. And again, Flight Explorer, even though they're showing this the day after, and they had a day to manipulate this, and they never, they're still showing it as flying, continuing on the day after. Now, I'm going to move on to Flight 93. This has far more evidence out of all the planes that it was still airborne, and some of it's quite damning evidence. On 9/11, the ACARS, which is the addressing system which I mentioned to do with Flight 175, it shows that Flight 93 was flying over Champaign, Illinois, which is near Chicago, and it's approximately 500 miles away from Pittsburgh, which is where Flight 93 was meant to have crashed. It was still in the air, receiving messages over Champaign, Illinois. Now, I'm going to sort of mention that, but I'll just mention this other area. Now, this is corroborated that it's flying around this vicinity by Colonel Marr in some of the 9/11 commission documents that I got hold of. And he said, and I quote him, United 93 was circling over Chicago, and that comes from Colonel Marr. So this is the ACARS. So Flight 93 would be here where it crashed, yet it was receiving messages here at 10, 11, 18 seconds a.m. Now, according to the official story, Flight 93 crashed at 10:03. So why is it still receiving a message, you know, after the crash in a place that's nowhere near where it crashed? That's impossible. You shouldn't be getting ACARS messages that were delivered to the plane. And we know it was delivered to the plane because it sounds an audio signal when it's delivered. It confirms its delivery. So this is impossible if that plane had crashed. So I contend, again, the plane did not turn round. It carried on in this direction around here. Now, Chicago's up here where Colonel Marr would have seen Flight 93. So we know about the radius, like radiuses involving ACARS, So we'd expect at least a couple of hundred mile radius of the ground stations. Now, if you look at this map, Jeremy, you can see all these little squares. These are all ACARS ground stations.
Yeah, so I would have picked up at least one or two of them before where that green arrow is.
Yeah. And it did. It picked up along here, it picked up along here, and it picked up along there. Because of time constraints, I've not shown all my slides, but I have done a comprehensive write-up of this, which is on my blog. Now, it should have been picking up ACARS messages here, look. You would have thought, or at least here at the very most, when it made the turn, allegedly. And just to add in, we know, apparently, now this I find quite farcical, but it slipped through the net, that when you look at the cell phone towers that were being connecting to apparent cell phones that were aboard that plane, we have Thomas Burnett's cell phone connecting to a tower in Fort Wayne, which is in this vicinity, believe it or not. So how that slipped through the net, I don't know, but I've got the records of those to do with which cell phone towers were actually routing those calls. And I'm not saying I believe those calls could be made, but for some reason they didn't mind putting that in there. Again, what this proves is that Flight 93 did not crash over here when it's receiving, you know, ground station communication with the ACARS ground stations. Now, this was Colonel Marr, who I said regarding it was circling over Chicago in 93. Now, this is the document it came from. So Marr told the commission staff that his focus was on UAL, that's the real code for that 93, which was circling over Chicago. Marr thought UAL 93 was waiting for word over what had been happening across the country to begin its attack. So, again, what was Marr being told about this, or what did he see on the radar screens with 93 over in Chicago, which is nowhere near Pittsburgh? So, again, that's another piece of damning evidence to show that that plane was not where we were told it was. It gets even stranger here now with Flight 93, because it's almost like two different organisations, FAA and the Air Traffic Control, were looking at two different planes. So this may have been a blip. This may not have been. I don't know. But I'll just explain. So we have other evidence on the Air Traffic Control. They gave Flight 93's last coordinates. They placed it 15 miles past the crash site in Shanksville. So they actually, the coordinates show it's 15 miles on from the crash site, heading towards Washington. That's what proves it couldn't have crashed there. Now, I'm just going to show you this. This comes from this document here. Again, there's a commission-sensitive document, and it says there, gives the last reported position of UA-93, and it gives you the coordinates. When you put that in, it shows that it was 15 miles past the crash site. Again, so it didn't crash in Shanksville. And there's what it looks like. There's the crash site. There's the official coordinates when you put them in. Very strange. We also have Linda Justice, who stated in official communication recordings as well that United 93 was flashing over Hagerstown, which is 68 miles past the crash site in Shanksville. So it's showing us a path where that other plane, because we have two planes now in two different locations identifying as Flight 93 at the same time.
Potomac 88, line of Pearl.
Potomac.
Pull up United 93. He's flashing at Hagerstown. Okay. I believe that you will hear about that plane shortly.
I'll take care.
Okay. No idea on destination and or altitude. We just put the routing in for a good guess.
Okay, I didn't.
Okay.
I did the United 93. Just a minute. Let me try that again. United 93.
Yeah. Gotcha. Got it. Thank you. Yes, what's going on?
United 93 has just been reported altitude by another aircraft at about 8,000 feet.
Okay, thank you.
United.
In Morgantown, Victor Fox is only going to flight
Hagerstown 88.
About Appleton on the
Hagerstown 88 line, Pearl.
United 254, I'm working on lower.
United 254.
You're calling Hagerstown on the 88 line?
I was, but I'm going to take the handoff back on United 93 right now, and we'll talk about it later if we
all
need
right.
to.
Okay.
Able, sir, if you could take a look or have somebody in the back take a look and see if you see traffic, he would be in your 5 o'clock position in 10 miles. We think he's at 8,000 feet.
He's doing.
Indian Head?
Yeah.
That routing I put on United 93?
Say that again.
The routing that's in on United 93 was only our best guess given the direction he was heading before, and Flo knows it, but that is not necessarily where he's going, so you need to make sure you keep track control of him.
Okay.
All right, bye.
There was also a change of flight plan to Reagan National Airport that was made, apparently from the plane, and this was reported in mainstream media sources as well. Does this lend further weight, with the evidence that Flight 93 was still airborne, being shown on Flight Aware that it landed at Reagan National Airport? So we have a screenshot, because there's two videos here, which are important as well, which I'll send you, showing the new flight plan reported and on here. But we also have a screenshot from 2013, which shows on Flight Aware that Flight 93 landed at Reagan National Airport. Very key airport, by the way, which no other researchers want to talk about, which is why I'm talking about it. So at 10:28 is when Flight 93 landed at Reagan National Airport. And we do have other evidence to back this up. I've got an Excel spreadsheet to show it landed there as well. This is just to go back quickly, because I've probably got this in the wrong order. But Hagerstown, there's the Flight 93 crash site. There's Hagerstown. So it's showing you the flight path it would have been taking to New York, to Washington. So what I'm sort of proving with this is I'm showing you that none of those four planes crashed at those targets. That's what I'm proving. And I'm using a lot of official data and some official sources and media sources, which were widely reported. You know, and just before I finish off this part of this presentation is we have another ex-pilot, I think he was, but a very knowledgeable account here from Steve Soule. And he even said he has no knowledge of any ELTs. I know we had this helicopter report that allegedly crashed into the North Tower, but he does say in this account he had no knowledge of ELTs on 9/11. So as I presented at the start, we have four plane crashes, but we don't have not one ELT to say a plane crashed. Now, out of four plane crashes, you'd expect, what, four or three or even one. We have none. And that is evidence to show that none of those four planes crashed at those named targets. So planes that are still airborne after the alleged crashes means no ELTs. So really, it stands to reason why we wouldn't have any ELTs, because they did not crash.
They were still in the air.
They were still in the air. So that's just part of that presentation to prove why I say.
Obviously that's the cliffhanger. I have to ask you now, what happened next?
So just moving on, you asked me about passengers on 9/11. Now, we are a little bit thin on the ground, evidence-wise, for passengers, because at two of the airports, they did not have CCTV. That's what we're told around the boarding gate area. And they've never produced any CCTV with those two airports, Newark and Boston Logan. So for me, the 9/11 Commission is pretty much hearsay on what they're saying with the hijackers. There's a lot of anomalies with passengers. I can't go too deep with that here, but it will be something I'm working on a presentation to do. Because again, it's quite a complex area to really show people. But I have done some work to find some new evidence to do with passengers, and it's at Dulles Airport. Now, I don't know if you're familiar with this photograph from Dulles.
I am not.
Okay, so this is a photograph that was taken of some school children with their teachers and two people here from National Geographic. They actually won a competition with National Geographic. This photo shows the children, the school teachers, along with two National Geographic representatives. There's a link there if anybody wants to try and follow that. I'm assuming this is took by the same lady who I shall sort of reveal in a minute, who took this photo of the children here and their teachers. But it also captured some other passengers who was on that flight here, who I have identified. I identified all these passengers who there was. Now, some people say, well, how do you know that photo is not photoshopped or anything like that? It could be, but I did track down a person who identified to some degree the person who took this photo. And I have checked to see whether this was Gate D26, which I did here. I've identified some of the areas at Dulles Gate D26, which is this here, that walkway. It's the only area that has the walkway as well and the fire extinguishers. So then passengers would have been located around there, going to board the plane. The lady who took the photographs of the children and some of the passengers, or inadvertently took some of the passengers, but, you know, getting on the plane here, these. She actually took this photo, which is at D26. So what he's suggesting is there was a plane. Now, I can't identify whether this is the actual plane that we were told, because I cannot find the tail number anywhere on here because of the way, the view of the plane. But this is at Gate D26. I've double-checked this, and I can confirm that there's some type of plane there. Now, I think this lady claimed that she took the photo after the people had got on the plane, and she took it from that boarding area. So this is quite significant because there's a lot of issues with the gate and the boarding of passengers on 9/11, which is something I have briefly written about and spoken about in the past. This emerged of Flight 77 at Gate Dulles, D26, Dulles Airport on 9/11. Now, I'm keeping the lady's name private because if I put it out there, I'm guessing a lot of people might head over and try and track her down. And what that could do is it might prevent her from sharing anything else, because it's a hot topic, the passengers. And if you're on the sort of Simon Shack route or Ace Baker or some of those, you know, they accuse people of, you know, oh, you're faking this, you're doing that, and the passengers were simulated. And what we experienced when we was making the film 9/11 Alchemy, when we contacted some of the second plane videographers, they don't want to talk to you because they've suffered like abuse, you know, been saying that they fabricated their videos. They're reluctant to talk to you because of what happened. I mean, Jennifer Spell, just to add, her name on the internet sort of didn't help her personal business, and she wishes she'd never took that video. So a lot of people don't know this, but this was when they were pushing the video fakery angle. So I'm reluctant. I have disclosed the person who took the photo, but people have to go and find that on my site.
But so she's still alive?
She's still there. She's still alive. And she's open that she took that photograph of that plane. Whether it's the plane that we think it was, I cannot identify it at that gate because I can't see the tail number. However, if we look at other data, we've got conflicts at the gate with Flight 77. The problem is, due to the inertial navigation system, which is the INS, when you put them lat longs in where that plane is situated, it's not situated at Gate D26, it's situated on the opposite side of the concourse at either Gate 19 or Gate 21, which is very strange. But if we go back to what we call the BTS, the Bureau of Transportation Statistics, it says in that data that Flight 77 never had any wheels off time, and it didn't have a tail number. the information. So what that's suggesting, when Jeff Hill rang up the Bureau of Transportation Statistics, he was suggesting that that plane was cancelled. And we have exactly the same for Flight 11, by the way. It suggests that that plane never left the ground. So some plane left the ground, presumably.
But not the official.
But maybe not the official plane, yeah. Because just to add to that, like I said, in the BTS with Flight 11, that shows there's no wheels off time and there's no tail number. Yet we've got recordings of Flight 11 leaving from Gate 32. But I've also got sources who it says that Flight 11 took off, or passengers were boarding at Gate 26 in Boston, this is, instead of Gate 32. And I've also got with Flight 11, now this is very strange with Flight 11, a guy called Wayne Kirk, again, this is all in the official documents, people who were interviewed. Wayne Kirk was a cleaner on Flight 11. When he finished around about half past seven, sorry, about 7 o'clock, normally you'd have all the flight crew gathering, milling about, getting things ready. He said none of that was taking place. There was only one or two, which he thought was odd. I'll go on a little bit of speculation here. What I think is happening when we look at the two lots of data, rather than trying to extinguish one set of data to show another, even though I'm not having time to mention, going to every detail why I'm coming to this hypothesis, what it suggests is a plane took off at Gate 32 with perhaps just crew on it, some minimal crew that was taking part in an exercise, with probably Betty Young and Amy Sweeney on it, that made those calls, that was heading to Washington. Now, from my research that I've done, I know there was reports at the White House that a plane had crashed into the White House at 8:46. And they even sent a fire crew out to the White House and a construction, a construction crew, because they thought it was damaged. Now, I know for a fact that they used to run exercises of scenarios of planes crashing into the White House, the Secret Service, and they're the ones that made that report. So whether Flight 11 was heading to Washington to take part in that drill, because just over the way from the White House and the Pentagon is Reagan National Airport. Now, not a lot of people want to talk about at this point is Reagan National Airport was actually closed for 23 days. The longest out of all the airports that were closed on 9/11, it closed for 23 days. And I would contend that they had at least two flights there, which was 93 and Flight 11. Definitely with Flight 93, but possibly with Flight 11. Because as you heard in the tapes that I played, the NORAD, it was flying to Washington. Now, Kevin Nasiphany, who actually organised a lot of these drills and scenarios, exercises, he commented when Flight 11 apparently hit the WTC North Tower at 8:46, he actually said, hang on, the drills are not, the exercises are not meant to start for another hour. Well, another hour would have been 9:46, which ties into the Secret Service report, and there's only one report of this to do with the Secret Service that was publicised, and I've got it. And they couldn't, the fire people who turned up and the construction crew, the collapse crew, they were like dumbfounded by, they're baffled by what they were called, because no plane had hit there, but perhaps they were, it seems likely they was running some type of drill of a plane crashing into that building at the White House.
What are the implications of this?
That's huge, because we know they were running drills on 9/11, war games. We know at least 17 planes were involved of squawking hijacking codes. They were suspected of being hijacked. Nobody talks about Delta 89. Everybody talks about Delta 1989, but they won't talk about Delta 89, which is flying in a different direction. It was squawking the hijacking code and then disappeared. And in the vicinity nearby, not far from where it disappeared, there was a fake ELT put out of a plane crash.
So what's going on here? Mass confusion.
Mass confusion and a cover of war games to carry out and execute the operation with those planes.
To actually kill the passengers.
Well, this is the thing. This is hard for me to say that because if you look at Betty Young's phone call, she actually says she was on flight 12, not flight 11. And she says it twice. And Amy Sweeney said the same. She was on flight 12.
The flights could have been switched.
Yeah. I've got evidence of duplicate flights taking. Well, I say taking off, but I've just got evidence of duplicate flights happening that day. 11 is one of them. 93 is one of them. So an example of, say, 175. The official time, they say, that Flight 175 took off was at 8:14. Now, in the BTS, Bureau of Transportation Statistics, it says it took off at 8:23. And we have an eyewitness who was behind Flight United 175, Stephen Miller, and he says he was behind it. Now, his plane took off at 8:29. He said he took off 3 minutes after... roughly 3 minutes after flight 175. Now, 3 minutes, let's give or take a minute or two, is not 8:14 when he's took off at 8:29. It's more closer to 8:23. So we've got two lots of airplanes. Now, that data that's sent to the Bureau of Transportation Statistics, it's not done by human error. It's not human error taking place. That's sent from all sorts of things like the ACARS data. You get like a sensor switch on the planes because the ACARS is also collecting data of those flights and the planes, how it's performing, everything. The moment the wheels leave the ground, contact with the ground, it's recorded, it's accurate. That gets sent to the Bureau of Transportation Statistics. And we have the same for Flight 93. We're told that that took off at 8:42. However, in the Bureau of Transportation Statistics, it shows it took off at 8:28, not 8:42. So do we discount one or the other? Because as I showed you with Flight 93, we have Flight 93 in two different places at the same time.
But what about the passengers?
This is something else. We've got an account from Triton White, he would be an ex-football player now. He was at Newark Airport, and there was a plane. When they came back on a Monday night from Monday night football in America, they would be on the tarmac getting off, and they were on their plane, and they seen passengers being loaded onto a plane. He did. And he was informed when he played his next game after 9/11, he was told that plane that they saw was Flight 93 loading its passengers on. Now, we know Flight 93 never loaded any passengers on the tarmac. We also know with Flight 93, again, this is in official documents, that Mark Bingham did not have a seat assigned to him. There was no seat assigned to Mark Bingham. Now, I know it was a little bit lax and different way of doing things back in 2001 in America on their planes. You know, it was more like getting on a train there. But they did assign seats. Now, he weren't assigned any seat. And that's official. That's in document, unclassified documents. And prove that. It's all very strange where the passengers are concerned. I am working on writing up about this in quite some detail because it is quite shocking.
It's mind-bending.
Yeah. But we've got Ellen Mariani. She went to court against President Bush and she wanted CCTV to prove her husband got on that plane on Flight 175 and they couldn't prove it to her. She died not knowing what really happened to her husband. What they've done is they've fragmented it up into, you're a no-planer, you're a plane hugger, passengers are all simulated. I've done a lot of work and research to try and find out what is really going on. You know, if I took the line that they're all simulated, nobody'd want to talk to me, as in, like, people to do with any of those type you know, getting in touch with them makes it very difficult to investigate, doesn't it?
Are there any people in existence that will say, that was my husband who was on the flight? Or, I mean, like, are there people who are directly connected to any of the passengers?
I've only seen some statements that have been hard to find. I've had statement analysis done on, well, briefly done on an interview with some of the families. It does suggest that some of them are telling the truth. And I think there's a percentage who really did lose someone. But I think there's also a percentage of some which are quite strange.
That aren't real.
That perhaps aren't real, or they was involved in some type of operation.
Yeah, but that's genius.
Yeah,
that's
yeah.
genius, because yeah. then you're crossing wires and you're making it very complicated to figure out what is true and what is not true.
Yeah, but what people want to do, Jeremy, is because it's like that, they want to discount one or the other. It has to be one or the other. They're all simulated, you know, but it doesn't always work in uniform like that. You know,
yeah, it's a bit of both.
Yeah, it's a bit of both, because that's what the evidence I'm finding is a bit of both. And I don't want to be drawn into saying I'm in that camp, I'm in that, because that I'm disqualifying evidence. And that's what they want you to do. They want you to be forced into a camp, and I'm not doing that. I've gone down that sort of road before, but I'm just going where the evidence has led me the last few years since we made the 9/11 Alchemy film, really, because, like I say, we come across where people didn't want to talk to you because of what has happened in the past with people like Kiltown, Ace Baker, various researchers really ditching those people who were, I can tell you now, somebody like Jennifer Spell was quite traumatised, but we know taking that video and ruined her business because of what was put on the internet about her, allegedly faking a video. We've also got this doing the rounds, a picture of Nicole Miller at Newark Airport, apparently. They're trying to say it's on 9/11. Now, I'm the one who's released this full version picture of this, normally a cropped off. Shows this here. This is actually taken the day before. There's an AA stand there. She's not getting Flight 93. That was misinformation put out. And as I said about Mark Bingham, wasn't assigned a seat on Flight 93. So just to head off then, as we close, Jeremy. Thanks for having me on, by the way. The impossible speed. Okay. So 767, 757s, they cannot fly at 700 feet. 1,000 feet, 583 miles an hour, which was Flight 175, and the other flight was similar, around the same sort of speed. Now, this is backed up by somebody called Steve Soule, which I've mentioned earlier, in his testimony to the commission. He even says that he was very alarmed when Flight 11 was doing 300 knots at under 10,000 feet. He was alarmed by that. Okay, so that's just something there. And the other thing is Jeff Hill, who rang up Boeing, they're on record as saying that a 767, 757 can't fly at that speed either. And I think some of the best evidence is Flight 587, which is a classic example of what would happen to a plane if it tried to come down at those speeds. The engines cannot cope. The engines got ripped off. This was because the vertical stabilizer snapped off because they said they was doing hard maneuvers with the rudder. Hard movement, sorry. So that is a good example of impossible plane physics. Dr. Wood mentioned that as well. And just we go on, some of the strange anomalies quickly. The Earth's magnetic field fluctuated between at 8:46, sorry, and 9:02. These are the times of the crashes, which is very odd. I don't know any plane crashes that do that. And that happened at 9:37 there as well. And also at 10:03 to 10:06, we got these fluctuations for Flight 93. And as I contended earlier, this technology that I'm talking about is very real, and it's a very clear and present danger in the future, which is why people need alerting to it, because it will be used against us. So people need to know about seeing isn't believing. We know that they had a secret program established in 1994, the holographic projector for PSYOPs. This was mentioned in Washington Post. Again, that program got made even more secret after that was mentioned. We know that's what they were thinking about doing in Baghdad, using that type of technology. We know the planes wasn't real, because you don't get these type of things happening, as you see the Norday brothers, of a wing and tail sections disappearing for 6 frames. We have that in multiple videos. It's not due to compression, and it isn't due to trick photography or trick video fakery or CGI, because we know loads of witnesses, and I have a personal friend who's seen the plane, second plane as well. So this is some type of technology they're using, whether it's cloaking technology to make it look like a plane. But I don't think missiles make a plane-shaped hole. I think there's a lot more going on, which is why we see this with the magnetometer data, when the plane-shaped holes are made. But this is not a 767 plane. Luke Horsham video, missing wings, impossible dynamics with the building collision.
It's just so absurd.
It is. It really is. Because we know them planes wasn't where they said there was. So this was Richard Hall's first radar. He thought there was something being projected in. He did great work on that, Richard D. Hall. Commend him for that. But this is a Navy patent that I produced and made people aware of in the 9/11 Alchemy film. It's tried to be played down that it cannot have these type of capabilities, but they talk of 3D volumetric ghost imaging projection as a decoy countermeasure. It's also mentioned as a threat to do with China in the RAND Corporation documents that they perhaps have technology, the Chinese now, to put 3D volumetric images into space, into thin air, ships, planes and things like that as a decoy measure. And PSYOPs. So that's the end of my presentation. There's all my links to, if anybody wants to go and see what I'm all about. I shall probably be posting on Substack more, and I shall be getting Rumble and Odyssey channels as I move away slowly from the Google minefield.
Mark, before we actually end the conversation, just some thoughts. If you were to summarize all of this into a single paragraph, what would that summary be?
I would say 9/11 was an attack on human consciousness, and it changed the energy frequency of what followed from that event. And I would also say that the technology that I've touched on there, and I've only touched on it because people don't believe in it, but it is a clear and present danger to what could happen in the future. So people need to understand that it's real. And if they use it in the future, like they did on 9/11, because they've only got to change them planes to, let's just say, a UFO and turning the towers to dust, you've got a so-called alien invasion. You've got a Project Bluebeam style event. So people have to be mindful of what they can do with that type of technology, because they've weaponized it and they don't want to use it for good.
Can you remember what you were doing on the day?
Yes, I was working, and I only heard it on the radio. And when I got home a couple of hours, 2 or 3 hours later, it was actually about 2:15 in the afternoon in the UK when it happened. So I'd not long come back from lunch at 1 o'clock when it all kicked off. But I only heard it on the radio. But when I got home, it blew my mind, because it was just shocking to see them towers, what happened to them. But it took me 2 or 3 years to get my head around it. Even though I was very open to things happening with Princess Diana, JFK, RFK, MLK, I was very open to that. But 9/11 was different, because I think there was some type of, shock and awe with them towers and, the whole story.
And of course, the COVID PSYOP made everything so much easier now to actually to reconsider.
Yes, yes. I think COVID's changed a lot of people's frequency of awareness. I don't really like to say woke people up, but, I suppose it has. And whereas I had maybe 20 years, or longer, even from 1988 to get to this point, I think for those people who woke up, it was a short space of time, and I think we've got to be a bit patient with them, even though it can be frustrating. I think we have to be patient because they've got a lot of info to take in and they're going down the rabbit hole. And they'll perhaps maybe look at, you know, for people like us to guide them as we go along.
Mm. Well, on that note, Mark Conlon, thank you for joining me in the trenches.
Thanks for having me on, Jeremy. I appreciate it very much. You have a good day.
If you enjoyed this podcast, please visit supportgerm.com.